Hey guys, how's it going? Check it out, it's already Monday morning again. Hope y'all had a good weekend. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hang on, I gotta stretch and yawn for a second. I should have done that before I went live on the thing. Alright. Yes, lots of important news to cover today. You have no idea how many emails have not been returned this morning. Can you do the show? Can you do the show? Can you do the show? Hey, you want to do the show? You can do the radio show? You want to do the radio show? No response whatsoever. Except from our good friend Chuck. Actually, I think maybe I'm the only guy that calls him that, and I probably shouldn't. Charles Goyette, the great Charles Goyette, author of The Dollar Meltdown and Red, Blue, and Broke All Over. Good stuff, man. And he's going to be on the show. Talk about, you know, the price of the empire, man. What it means to you. All right. And then the good thing is the show's 2 hours long, so maybe we'll get emails back and maybe we'll have even more interviews than that. In fact, I think chances are pretty good. Because I got about 3 times more invites out than I have spaces for interviews. So, it's gotta work, right? Alright, now, hey, over the weekend, went down to the Ron Paul birthday party. It was his 80th birthday party down there in Lake Jackson. And I got there kind of late. I saw about probably the second half of Ron's speech. Missed the judge, missed Lou. Miss Tom Woods, they all gave speeches too. Well, they were just talking about how much they like Ron, so I pretty much already know what they said. Same thing I just said. But it was cool. Got to see Tom and everybody. I wanted to say hi again to some of the people that I was happy to see there. First of all, John and Ben, my friends from L.A., who I really miss. Those guys, man, I wish I had money where I could travel and stuff like that. I'd go out to L.A. just to see my homeboys every once in a while at least, you know. But it was great to see them. And Muriel was there with her husband. Hi to Muriel. Of course, Roger and Jed. And I got to meet Greg and Joy, who were really nice. And the Pavonis. Remember the Pavonis, the conscientious objectors? They were there too, husband and wife team. And they promised to start writing again soon. And then, of course, my old friend Haji, Dennis Marburger, who I one time interviewed on this show about the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan and all this complicated mess back years ago. I guess he can no longer listen live because of his work routine nowadays, but he was, personality on the blog and the chat room and hung out for many years. So it was cool to see him. And then, of course, I got to meet a whole hell of a lot of other people whose names I don't remember, but I want to make sure and say hi to those people, and nice to see you, and see you again, and meet you, and all that. And then I got to give Ron, for his birthday present, I gave him a CD of, a DVD with all of my interviews with him on it. And he goes, oh, let me see. I said, yeah, there's 29 of them. And he says, oh, man, my people just, they're not doing a very good job with the screening, are they? I told him, no, Jeff Dice used to always try to keep you off pirate radio, but I just lie to him and bring you on anyway. Jeff used to be his chief of staff in his congressional office. He's now the president, chairman of the Mises Institute. So we had a good laugh about that. Anyway, so that was cool, man. I got to see good old Ron Paul again and got to see Lou and Tom and everybody, like I said. And yeah, I don't know. It was cool, man. I love Ron Paul, dude. He's great. I kind of had the idea that he had been made aware. I hope he didn't hear it. I don't know. He must have been made aware of the debate between myself and Walter Block. And I guess I don't know this, but I guess Ron must know that I bash his son all the time. And I feel really bad about that because I really have personal feelings for Ron. You know, I met him however many times, I don't know, half dozen times or whatever. And I just really like the guy. I mean, he's my hero. And here I am bashing his boy. But the problem is this boy's a senator. And he keeps doing things that drive me nuts. So, you know, I can't not say it. Wait. Yeah. I can't not say it. Gotta say it. So, it is what it is. I think, you know, he kind of understands, and I think he likes me less, honestly, but not too much less, you know, but a little less. But oh well, it is what it is. And you know what? What if there was no libertarians complaining about Rand? What if Rand just had all the libertarians locked up no matter how bad he got on anything, you know? That would be bad. Because he'd be even less libertarian than he is now. He's got to have that pressure on him. Somebody's got to do it, you know? Anyway. I don't know if you guys heard the debate on Tom Wood's show. I guess many of you probably did. I did not equip myself that well as far as the debating skills go, the way... Or, I don't know, you know, Walter frames the debate the way he wants to, and then, you know, I didn't always think of the best way to answer him on his own terms. I saw a lot of people pointed out after the debate, people said on Twitter or on Facebook comments or whatever that I noticed, they made arguments that I should have made. You know, there were quite a few of those. A few that I thought of myself after the thing was over, and a few that others had pointed out. Someone had pointed out to me that really, on the face of it at least, I don't know, you'd have to go through with a fine-tooth comb or something, but on the face of it, Lincoln Chafee actually is far more libertarian than Rand. If Walter Block says it's our obligation to vote or support the most libertarian candidate, well, Chafee, he's kind of a rhino liberal Rockefeller Republican turned Democrat is who he is. But compared to a conservative, he's pretty damn libertarian. And on issues of war and peace in the Middle East, he's better than Rand. I mean, the guy's a joke, whatever. He's got no charisma, no power, no money, no influence, no chance, no nothing. Doesn't matter. But I'm just saying, if that's the litmus test. And then someone else was pointing out, you know, the way Walter tried to say, well, it's all about the reducto ad absurdum and this and that. So you're saying we can't vote for Rand because he has violations of libertarianism, but Ron had them too. And so you're a hypocrite. But that's like saying, well, Ron violated some libertarian principle, and so you have to support any other candidate running. Because surely they all agree with libertarianism on something. And it's wrong to insist on, you know, scoring all of their deviations against them or something, you know, using that as an excuse. What I was trying to say was, you know, for a libertarian to support a Republican or a Democrat for the presidency, you gotta pass a really high hurdle, you know? He even said, and I should have used his example of Obama. He said he supported Obama against McCain because he was afraid McCain would get us all killed. Now, for me, I walked that line differently. What I said was, I oppose McCain more. I don't support Obama at all. But yeah, I think McCain will get you nuked. I think we would all be dead right now. We'd have had a nuclear war with Russia and we'd all be dead. America wouldn't even exist right now if John McCain had won in 2008. I still didn't vote for him, and I sure as hell didn't tell people to go out there and support him. What I did was I tried to debunk everything about Obama that I could. He's no peacenik. Look, he wants to expand the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He says he's, you know, he's got all these, he's already contradicted himself on the telecom stuff. He's already put wiggle words in his terminology when he talks about closing Guantanamo and ending torture and this kind of thing. So, I just opposed McCain more, but I certainly never supported Obama. I don't know how I would have been obligated to support Obama or Rand Paul for that matter. So, that's what I should have said, and then I'd have won more gooder. I mean, better-ish. Or further more. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
Hey, cool, man. So Patrick L. Smith is going to come back on the show. We're going to talk about Russia and Ukraine and stuff.
Cool. Oh, yeah. You know what I should do is I should reply to myself here. Say also at, let's see, so FLOU. Isn't it? Floutist? Oh, well. Thought I knew his Twitter handle. Yeah, Patrick L. Smith. He's got an article we're running today. On antiwar.com. About the Ukraine crisis. So that's pretty good. I like Ukraine crises interviews. Not so much the crises themselves. Good, good. So then I can skip to my next section here. I guess we'll go ahead and go with the rock news. Suicide bombers attack soldiers, 136 killed from yesterday. 150 to 200 killed in Libya. Oh, that's ISIS news, but not Iraq news. Hang on, I'll get back to that in a minute. So is that, well, you know, I had a probably unwanted program that View snuck in there that erased all my tabs, and I had to go from memory and I forgot my ones. I lost a couple, man. I lost some tabs. Ramadi and Fallujah. That was what I wanted to cover. Wait, did I have a separate section? Cause I had some Fallujah stories here. Where'd that go? Yeah, okay, I suck at this. I know, I'm winging it. The U.S. military is saying today, according to antiwar.com, it was yesterday, they said that the Iraqi army, so-called, I guess they mean the Shiite militias, have Ramadi half surrounded. Well, so what about Fallujah? Did they break the siege in Fallujah? Or there's enough Shiite militiamen to lay siege to Fallujah and to Ramadi too? Does that sound right to you? And they're saying, oh yeah, Maliki's guilty of failing to hold on to Mosul and Ramadi, but it's foreign territory, man. Patrick Coburn reported on this show a year before the fall of Mosul that the Iraqi army left Mosul. These guys quit their posts and went home. They're way out past the lines and without the support. That was a year before the Islamic State showed up. I mean, I guess some must have gone back, but just goes to show you how little support they felt they had for being out there, you know. Sky News says U.S. hits Islamic State as Iraqi troops killed in Fallujah. 17 troops killed by suicide bombers in Fallujah. And you know what, man? I don't think we ever talked about this on the show. I had the tab open for a while and lost it eventually or something, but there was some in-depth report. I can't remember where it was anymore. But someone had done a really in-depth story about all the armored-up Humvees. You know, remember that? You know, you go to war with the army that you have, and they sent our guys off to war in aluminum trucks. I mean, a Ford Ranger at least has steel doors, right? They sent them out there in Humvees and with aluminum chassis and aluminum, you know, walls. The body is what I'm trying to say. And the guys decided they would rather have no doors than worthless doors. So if there's no doors, it's easier to try to escape the damn thing if the bomb goes off on the other side of the truck, at least. It took them forever. Remember all the stories, guys, digging in the scrapyard to try to find pieces of steel to put down on the floorboard. Try to save their legs from getting blown off. Oops. And, yeah, man, I forgot to turn my dinger off. So then they finally got the armored up Humvees and then later the MRAPs too. But so they sent over thousands of these armored up Humvees. Thousands of which were seized by the Islamic State when they sacked Mosul and Ramadi. I guess Fallujah before that. Well, it turns out that armored up Humvees make for great suicide bomb trucks. Because, hey, they got bulletproof glass. Or, you know, bullet resistant. And, hey, they're up armored. And so, you could have a suicide attacker driving up in an armored up Humvee. The captain says, light them up, boys, and it doesn't do any good. They breach the perimeter and blow themselves up anyway. Because now, finally, the trucks, they made them tough enough in time for America to leave. And leave them to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is all ISIS is. Really. And, yeah, but anyway, so now here they are trying to take Fallujah and Ramadi back, and it's the same old story here. Patrick Coburn said that Sistani, the Ayatollah Sistani, was telling the Shiite militias, please don't be sectarian about this. I think more or less, you know, you could read between the lines. We're not trying to steal this territory. We're just trying to fight the Islamic State political organization. Now, he's the supreme Ayatollah. He has a higher religious rank in Shiite Islam than the Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, even though he's more of a political leader than Sistani is. Sistani does get involved in politics from time to time anyway, and he has said things like this. But I think that's way too little too late, because the Shiite militias who are doing the fighting are the very same guys. The very worst sectarian fighters. They're as bad as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, really, on the Shiite side. I know Coburn says he disagrees with that, but, you know, I don't know, man. 2007, the Badr Brigade just leaving, and the Mahdi Army, too, just leaving Sunni corpses piled on the side of the road like cordwood, hundreds a night. We told you to get the hell out of this neighborhood, didn't we? This is what happens when you don't get the hell out of this neighborhood, they said. Stacking bodies on the side of the road with drill holes in their, all through their bodies. And then through their eye holes and through their skulls. What a way to die. Can you imagine that? That's America's allies. I almost said America's sock puppet militias over there, but who was whose sock puppet really, huh? The U.S. Army, the U.S. Marine Corps, the National Security Council, the Department of Defense, and the CIA. They were all working for Iran. And the Supreme Islamic Council and the United Iraqi Alliance of the Dawah Party and Muqtada al-Sadr all along in that war. So, who's zooming who, you know what I mean? So I don't think the people of Ramadi or Fallujah are going to welcome these Shiite militias. I think they're just going to be pushed further into the hands of the Islamic State. Whether they really have the money and arms to resist, I guess, is a different story. But manpower-wise, this is probably doing them a favor.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberg, a tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe.
All right, you guys. Welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I've got Patrick L. Smith, the most worthwhile part of Salon.com, by a long shot. The U.S.-Russia phony war. How Washington warmongers could bring us from stalemate to catastrophe. And, yeah, whenever somebody says catastrophe and they're talking about the United States and Russia, my ears perk up, or my eyes. Oh, no. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Patrick?
I'm well, Scott. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to talk again.
Yeah. Very happy to have you here. So, first of all, let's talk about the stalemate. There is a peace agreement called Minsk II. To what degree is it actually still in effect? Are you worried that its days are numbered? Can you describe what conditions it's supposed to set and the difference between that and what we got right now?
Sure. Large question. Give me a little time with it. Sure. Minsk II was signed in February. It was the second ceasefire agreement. The first one fell apart, also signed in Minsk. Both of these are in part sponsored by the Belarus president, okay? They involve the Europeans, the Russians, and the Ukrainians. The Americans, your readers, your listeners ought to note, were not invited. The Minsk II agreement is very fragile, but it's what we have. It is what stands between a negotiated solution and open warfare. So it is fragile. There are some number of transgressions on a daily or weekly basis. We know this, but it's what we have. So and it remains, importantly, it remains the basis for a negotiated settlement. What we're looking at now is a situation where the Kiev government is some combination of unwilling or unable to carry out the terms of the Minsk agreement. They call for a ceasefire, a sort of LOC, line of control, I guess, designated on maps, withdrawal of heavy artillery, et cetera, et cetera. And Kiev is supposed to begin conducting negotiations with the eastern provinces, including in the agreement, the leaders of the rebel organizations, concerning the devolution of power, a redone constitution, more or less, you're not supposed to use the word over there, but more or less the federalization of Ukraine, a very high degree of autonomy. Anyone looking at this situation with any detachment must recognize that this is a deeply bifurcated country, culturally, historically, politically, ideologically, what have you. And the best way to keep it together is to federalize it. We Americans, living as we do in a federation of states, ought to be right on board. Now, Kiev, one, they are to some ever more apparent extent unable to execute the terms of Minsk because they are too dependent on far-right groups who are quite prepared, have said so, to topple this government, to take it right down, if they negotiate with the East. That's one. That's the unable part. The unwilling part is that the U.S., with the single exception of Kerry, and maybe we want to return to this topic later on, is not for a negotiated settlement. They want a military settlement for the simple reason that they do not want a federated Ukraine. That wouldn't be a really very much fun client state, would it? So to engage the Kiev government is to engage the Americans and our wishes, our leadership's wishes. And that's a yet larger problem, okay? That's how I see it laying out now. And that is why, as I said in the column that brings us together today, I really don't trust this sort of lull or doldrum or whatever you wish to call it in events on the ground over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen other people actually also noticing, and I noticed the first time, but the Summer of the Shark 2001, oh, Gary Condit's intern is missing or whatever, and all this, and it was like, oh, man, there's another shoe fixing to drop on all of our heads right now,
yeah,
and
yeah.
It kind of feels that way to me, too. But now, so Merkel came to the U.S., and I'm paraphrasing, told Obama, sit down, shut up, and get the hell out of our way, because me and the French, we're going to go over there and make a deal with Putin, and we're going to have a peace agreement here. And Obama said, okay, go ahead, right? And they did.
Yes, I think Merkel is a very complicated character, okay? It is the first time in my life I've had any time whatsoever for a Christian Democrat, but she is, as I said, quite a complex figure. On the one hand, she is, in a certain way, running the frontline Western European state, excluding the former Soviet satellites. She is right there. German business, everybody knows these facts. German business is very, very deeply involved in Russia. Okay, capital investment, banking matters, fixed investment, construction, infrastructure, all this sort of thing. People come back from Russia and say every other crane is German, right? So she's got that. She doesn't want a war on her border, of course. On the other hand, Merkel is an extremely devoted Atlanticist. She does not want... Remember, she grew up in Eastern Europe, Eastern Germany. She does not want to precipitate a breach in the Atlantic Alliance. She's very NATO, let's say. Okay, so that's the other side of her. I think your listeners, when we're thinking about Merkel, you got to think about these two dimensions of her outlook, her perspective. Okay. Now, yes, she came to Washington and seems to have put her foot down with Obama, and that was the first Merkel speaking. Look, Mr. President, we really can't let this go a lot further. One, two, the Kiev government is so unreliable; it is almost impossible to deal with them. So let us get this done. And Obama, we can't but speculate, Scott, of course, but by appearances, Obama seems to have acquiesced. Kerry went to Sochi, the Russian resort town, your listeners may recall, and smoked the peace pipe with Putin, quite a remarkable turn, right? However, post-Sochi, things have not improved. And it looks to me as if the Obama administration, I've argued for some time, is fighting a war on two fronts, against the Russians, but also the Europeans, who want a negotiated settlement. And now the administration, more particularly, has an internal struggle, it seems to me, going on between what we broadly call the warmongers, and those such as Obama and Kerry, and I'm now quite convinced that those two head a camp that would like to see a negotiated settlement.
Right. I'm sorry, hold it right there, Patrick.
People like Vicki Newland, right?
Yeah, right. We'll pick it up right there on the other side of this break with Patrick L. Smith, y'all.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey. Welcome back, y'all. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Patrick L. Smith, writing at salon.com, the U.S.-Russia phony war. How Washington warmongers could bring us from stalemate to catastrophe. And where we left off, we're talking about the war party in the United States and just how much power and influence they still have, even on this issue. And I wonder, what makes you think that Obama sides with Kerry rather than with Newland on picking this fight? Because he could have just got rid of her a long time ago, or marginalized her, assigned her to some other job, something.
Yeah, very true. Good question. And it's the proof of what a good question is an answer is not easy, Scott, okay? I don't know what these people, and Newland is not to be singled out. She's just the most visible. I don't know what these people are doing there. I don't know what Samantha Power is doing at the UN, et cetera. I think there's an argument either way, okay? Obama is responsible for these appointments, notably Samantha Power, okay? It may be that he is as complex a man as Merkel is in a European context, you know, a person of many minds. I can't answer it, Scott. I wish I could. I can't answer it with certainty. But it has occurred to me, and this, I suppose, is what I was getting at before our break, it has occurred to me that Obama has a kind of attenuated latitude, alternatives within the power structure of Washington as he inherited it, okay? This is not a new theme. To what extent does the tail wag the dog? To what extent have defense and intelligence agencies staged over who knows how many years a kind of silent coup in Washington, right? We cannot know that.
Well, but it's impossible really to imagine that Obama didn't know that Soros and the NED and all these guys were working on another color-coded revolution in Ukraine after they did the same damn thing 10 years before.
A point well made and taken, Scott. Yes, that's true. This stuff has gone on. It kind of grinds on year after year. These corrupted NGOs, supposedly over in Russia and elsewhere doing good, well-intentioned things, and they are not good and they are not well-intentioned. That's true. But I don't think it necessarily contradicts my suggestion of at least complexity on the matter.
No, I'm with you.
In this way.
We talked about before, when Merkel came to town and said, hey, come on, man, Obama seemed to say okay. And then as we spoke about before, and as you mentioned, he sent Kerry, and Kerry went and met for 4 hours with
Putin and Lavrov, and they seem to be getting along, and they are obviously working together on the nuclear deal. There are new reports that maybe they're going to work together on some Syrian peace talks. So,
right.
But then again, in your article, you point out that they're still rigging this MH17 investigation against the Russians, and in fact, you talk about how the Treasury announced new sanctions as a matter of course here.
Right. The Pentagon, last time we spoke, Scott, some weeks ago, the Pentagon had begun training the Ukrainian National Guard, which is which consists of reconstituted far-right militias. That's what we mean by the National Guard. Don't expect our newspapers to explain that to you, but that's what we mean.
The right sector and the Azov Battalion.
Yeah. Now we have a very recent announcement, part of what prompted me to write this column. We are now training the regular Ukrainian army. Wait, you have to step back and say, what is it we're not training at this point? That is why I said, and I stand by the assertion, de facto, we are running the Ukrainian defense. That's a very aggressive thing to do.
It means that we're in the middle of a kind of pseudo ceasefire where there's still fighting going on, if not official war. There's still skirmishes all the time. You have at least accusations, never mind the thousands of mythical infantrymen, but at least there are plausible accusations of Russian special forces helping coordinate the resistance fighters on their side. You have Americans on the ground training with these guys. You could really have Americans and Russians trading fire in no time here.
That's right. And let me this will surely get me in trouble with still more readers and listeners than I am already, but let me make this point. I will stand by it. I am rather pleased that the Russians are doing whatever they're doing, and I don't claim to know precisely what it is, but generally we get the idea. If they weren't there, there would be no balance whatsoever, and these people in Kiev would absolutely overrun the East. We have an official figure of 6,400 deaths. Throw it away. The German intelligence agencies put it at 50,000. The 6,400 is what they count in the morgues. That's all. We're looking at a situation where there are, by German intel reports, these are published in Europe. They're not unknown. They're just not published here. About 50,000. That's pretty serious. And it's all occurring in the East, of course. Once again, at the risk of provoking the ire of your listeners, I think it's probably net a good thing that the Russians are there.
Well, I mean, the argument's been made. It was, on balance, a good thing that American traitors gave Russians plans for nukes, too, because America would have nuked Russia in a preemptive war. We would have started a war against them if we had maintained the monopoly, is what I'm trying to say.
You mean back in the late 40s?
Yeah, back then.
Yes, right.
So, it makes sense. It doesn't mean that, you love a foreign power or whatever. You're just making a kind of cynical observation about the position our government has put us in. That's all.
That's
we understand
right.
What you mean.
Here's the underlying principle. Think of it this way. Deterrence was sort of a chiseled in granite principle back during the Cold War, justifying these immense, ridiculously overbuilt nuclear arsenals, right? But it all had to do with deterrence. Well, this is another variation of deterrence, is it not?
I would like to think so, but apparently no. I mean, that's that's the crisis that we're talking about here, is that we seem to be, I don't know who's we, our leaders seem to be kind of, I don't want to say sleepwalking, but in a way, they're kind of half-assing us into war with Russia, it looks like to me. You know, they're not. This isn't the focus of all their attention. Sort of like on this show. All my attention's on the Middle East, where the big game is going on over there on Poland's eastern border. And, you know, in the Baltic states and stuff. And, where they had American soldiers parading around just a couple of hundred yards from the Russian border.
Russians are aggressing because they're carrying out training and military exercises on the Russian side of the border. That's aggression.
Yeah, and I'm reading
We're a couple of hundred miles or less from Russia's western border. As I said last time we spoke, Scott, I think the mess Obama will leave behind in Russia and whatever complexities we want to read into the Obama White House, his name is on it. The mess he will leave behind on Russia's western border is his worst foreign policy legacy by a long way.
And that assumes we make it to, inauguration day for Jeb or whatever, whoever's next.
You're an optimist, I take it.
Well, I'm trying to be. And, I've learned that alarmism usually doesn't pay off, but sometimes it does. And this is the kind of thing where even if President Trump and President Putin are the best of friends getting along, disarming the H-bombs of both sides still should be the highest priority of every human on this planet, assuming we want our species to survive. So, I mean, there's nothing more important than America-Russia's relationship, period. I mean, I don't even think that's an opinion. I think that's just a scientific observation or something.
Yeah,
we got to get this right. So, anyway,
Stephen Cohen, the historian, made this point some while ago. Every national security question facing the United States, from nuclear arms to climate control, runs right through Moscow. Mm-hmm. There is no denying that. It's as vital as we used to say the relationship across the Pacific was with Japan, right? Famously the most important bilateral relationship, bar none, said Mike Mansfield, right? Well, Washington-Moscow is the key to more or less everything wanting resolution right now, and sleepwalking is just the term. We're just not addressing this. I make this point often. I make it as often as I can. We Americans have no idea how scarred we are by Cold War ideology, Cold War thinking, propaganda, and all the rest of it. I don't know how old you are, Scott, but maybe I have a few years on you. Believe me, it runs very deep, and it limits our capacity to renovate our thinking. It limits our capacity to reimagine relationships, and it's going to sink our ship if we don't come to terms with this. Mm-hmm. Regrettably, there's no sign of it. The source of my optimism is very simple. We can do it if we decide to. I hold to that.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and of course, what's working against us the most, other than just, the behavior of our government in the first place, is, as you often point out in your column here, the media and the way they just will never tell the truth. I was reading an article about Ukraine last night that, of course, says that the crisis all started when Russia invaded Crimea. And so then never mind the coup or any of that. Just pretend that never existed. And never mind the fact that they didn't invade Crimea from Russia. They invaded Crimea from bases they had at Crimea and that not a single person was killed. They just kind of walked outside and said, this is Russia again now. But
let me share this with your readers. A couple of months ago, RT ran a very lengthy Q&A session with Putin live. Okay, he recounted this whole matter and how the Crimean annexation came about. The evening of February 22nd, when the Ukrainian coup was an established fact, he gathered his closest aides and said, ladies and gentlemen, we need to begin right now thinking about what we're going to do about Crimea. The moment has arrived. And by 7 the next morning, they had a plan, and we watched the consequences of that plan.
Mm. And now, he explained it perfectly in a speech, too.
I don't know what is.
Yeah, he explained it in a speech, too, joking and saying, I thought about how nice it might be to go down to Sevastopol to visit our NATO friends and say hi, guys. But then I decided that, we would rather just keep the base ourselves.
Did he say that?
Yeah. It'd be great. We love visiting our NATO friends. And, that would be a great place to visit them. But instead, I think we're just going to go ahead and hold on to it.
Right.
It seems like Americans could understand that. I brought that up to Eric Margolies, and he said, you know, this is like if we were talking about Houston, Texas, okay? Never even mind, like, one of our outposts in the Pacific or something like that. This would be like, you know, and he talked about, you know, remember the Alamo? Well, the Russians lost hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of soldiers over Crimea fighting the Germans. Think they're just going to give that up to NATO? Never. Give me a break.
No.
But we don't see that in that context. You have to be Eric Margolies and have that wide kind of understanding of the world to be able to see it that way. Or you got to hear Eric on this show. Otherwise, people just never get it explained to them from the Russian point of view, you know?
I agree. And I urge your listeners to go back. Historically, Crimea is very, very interesting. In effect, it's been part of the so-called Great Game competition between the Brits and now the Americans. And the Russians for control over the Khyber Pass and that whole area of the world. Crimea has been a locus of contention for well back into the 19th century, right?
Well, it was officially annexed by Russia the first time in the 1780s when we were still under the Articles of Confederation here.
Right. Well,
thanks for coming back on the show, Patrick. We're way over time, and I got to let you go. But I sure appreciate you coming back on.
You're very welcome, Scott. We'll do it again.
Yes, I hope so.
Cheers.
All right, y'all. That is Patrick L. Smith. He's at Salon.com, the U.S.-Russia phony war, how Washington warmongers could bring us from stalemate to catastrophe. It's a really good one. It's in the viewpoint section today at antiwar.com. And we'll be right back with Yosef Butt in just a sec. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all. Whew. I think I got that done by the skin of my teeth there. Chat room guys, talk to me, man. I need to know. All right. Hey, check it out. I got Yosef Butt on the line. He is a nuclear physicist and is a senior scientific advisor to the British American Security Information Council in London. He's got this brand new one at Reuters, Why It's Impossible to Hide Nuclear Work in 24 Days or 24 Years. Welcome back to the show, Yosef. How are you doing?
Good. Good to be back.
Good. Very happy to have you here. So obviously what's at issue in this article is the Iran nuclear deal, and one of the major objections or perhaps kind of pretended objections to the deal, which is that under the terms of the deal, in the worst case scenario, Iran could drag out a snap inspection of a military site, not any nuclear site that's already safeguarded, but any other site that is a so-called suspicious site. They could drag out that inspection for up to 24 days and then sneak all their research out the back door. And by the way, I don't want to set up too easy of a straw man for you, so I'll go ahead and say, and what if it's not necessarily nuclear material they're messing with? What if they're just working on an implosion system and they're using lead or tungsten as a pretend fissile material there and in testing the implosion system? They could sneak that out the back door in 24 days, but not leave any radiological-type materials behind. So what about that, too?
Yeah, well, you know, basically, people were objecting that there's this delay before inspections can take place. But like you said, the actual nuclear facilities that are declared will be in continuous safeguard. So they'll, at any time, there can be snap inspections. And if Iran tries to put that off, these sanctions could snap back on. So it's not like it's getting a free pass. Now, what this applies to, this 24-day maximum rule, is any place in Iran that's suspicious. So this is no country in the world allows you to come in and just walk up to any military site or anything and just like walk in.
Could you imagine UN inspectors trying to walk around Texas like that? Hey, let us into Fort Hood to look at whatever we want.
Exactly. So they basically worked out in this deal that, hey, there's going to be two where we can chat and figure out a way to get in. And then there's, a few more days after that, like 10 more days to work out a methodology to get in. And basically, once you're in, any nuclear material can be picked up very easily, even if they've tried to sneak it out, because this is microscopic dust that, there's instruments right now that the sensitivity allows you to pick up even trace fingerprint amounts of nuclear material. So, people who say that you can clean up a nuclear site are just wrong. So, you'd take swipes, you'd go in cracks in the room, in bolt holes, at the corners of the room, at where the walls meet the floor, et cetera, and you'd take an ultra-clean cotton cloth and pass it along those events. Those would be processed in labs and any microscopic, down to nanogram amounts, the 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram could be picked up. So there's no hiding this. And it doesn't matter if it's, 10 days, 24 days, 24 years, you'll pick this up. So, the objection's a bit contrived.
Yeah, sure seems like it. Okay, now, and that really is an important point that's worth going back to about the full inspections at the declared nuclear facilities. They'd have to somehow divert nuclear material from, somewhere along the chain between the mine, the conversion facility, the enrichment plant, to have anything to make a bomb with anyway. And how are they supposed to get away with that when now those inspections are expanded permanently? And I think, the reason it's really worth going back over this most elementary point here is because they're kind of lying when they talk about this 24 days, Yosef, because the war party side, they never specify that they're not talking about the nuclear sites. They don't necessarily lie about that directly and say, oh, no, they can close down Natanz for 24 days or anything like that. But they just sort of imply that the inspections, have all these obstructions to them without ever addressing the other part, like we talked about, that every bit of declared nuclear material from womb to tomb in the entire cycle in Iran will be safeguarded 24 hours a day, 100% of the time, under the additional protocol, much more than ever before. This is
Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically, Iran, the way things are right now, or what's been agreed to, would have the toughest inspections rules ever. So why wouldn't you agree to that? I mean, it doesn't get tougher than that in any country. So, that's the bottom line.
Right. Okay. Now, so what about though if they're testing, an implosion system, for example, for a bomb? But without nuclear material, because you could do that with lead, right?
There's a couple of points there. Number one, you do these kind of tests with high explosives for conventional military. So that is actually technically legit. I mean, if it doesn't involve nuclear materials, then, you can't really make a huge objection to it. I mean, they could be doing it to test regular chemical bombs. Not chemical weapons, but
conventional explosives. You mean
conventional explosives? So, you cannot just tell them to stop all their military activity. So, part of this can go on. Heavy elements. These swipe samples can pick up other things too. It's not just that they'll pick up only fissile cells. So, if you're particularly concerned about lead, there'll be signatures for that. You can do mass spectroscopy. You can, there's various ways to pick up the elements of interest. But, you know, the point being that you can't object very loudly to them doing non-nuclear stuff. I mean, that's not something that as far as I know, that's been agreed to. I mean, it would be against the spirit of the agreement, but they probably wouldn't be breaking the letter of it, even if they did that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, and all of this is really, I don't know all of it, but much of this is actually about Parchin, the military facility, and the accusations that they had a bomb chamber where they were testing explosives there. Now, my friend Gordon Prather, who used to make H-bombs and stuff at Sandia National Laboratory, was the chief scientist of the Army. He's explained to me that that's not how you do it. You test them outside. Not in an explosive chamber like this. And I think Robert Kelly, the former chief of the Iraq inspections regime for the IAEA back in the early 90s, he's written a pretty compelling piece for Loblaw called The Parchin Puzzle, where he seems to cast doubt on this explosives chamber's even existence at all, I think. And especially, you know, as Gareth Porter has also debunked, the cooperation of this supposed former Soviet nuclear physicist, bomb maker, but in fact he wasn't a nuclear physicist at all, this guy Danilenko. And anyway, I just wonder, you know, if you could give us your summation of what you think about the Parchin accusations, whether the thing is just all wet or how that plays into this 24 days. And really, what do the Iranians care? Why don't they just let him come back to Parchin three more times or whatever and just get this story debunked, because it's obviously, you know, bogus in the first place?
There's a few points to make about Parchin.
Sorry.
You know, why don't they let them back in? I think they're willing to do that as long as there's a plan to resolve it. I think what's not desired from their side is that they'll now go in, they find nothing here, and there's another building of interest after 2 weeks. And they don't want this wild goose chase to go on, because the IAEA already came twice in 2005 and looked at different parts of Parchin, I think five buildings. Each time they found nothing at all, nothing suspicious, nothing dual use, no nuclear material. So now they have a new building of interest, and I think, I don't know what the detailed negotiations are, but I think what's going on is they just want a work plan to resolve it. They don't want, hey, you'll come in here, you'll find nothing, and then there'll be another building of interest.
Mm-hmm.
In
other words, you're saying they'll agree to it, but they want to have in writing what's going to happen.
They want a flow chart of like how this will get resolved, not that you'll keep asking to come back in each time you find nothing, because this is a sensitive military site from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So now, Parchin, the main point I'd like to make about that is that whatever is happening, the place that you want to take samples from, these samples that I talked about earlier, is from inside the building. So now all this propaganda that's been put out by the ISIS folks run by David Bright is wrong. They're talking continuously about stuff that's happening outside. What you want to do is go inside the building, take swipes. If there is a chamber, Iran has done a great favor to the IAEA, because they can go into the chamber and they can take swipes and they can pick up any nuclear material that was there used ever, even if there's been sanitization, even if Iran's been trying to clean it, because you cannot dilute it down to the amount that you won't pick up these nanogram amounts of nuclear material. So if Iran did have a chamber in there, that's great for the IAEA, because that concentrates the nuclear material, if there was any nuclear material.
Mm-hmm.
So all this talk about paving outside and bulldozers and cars and, you know, suspicious activity is all wrong. I mean, what's happening of interest is inside the building. Now, if they demolish the building and they pave it over, yeah, that's suspicious. But as long as that building is standing, people can go in. Even if it's been properly cleaned up, you can still pick up nanogram amounts of material, and you can pick that up. So, you know, just watch out for the propaganda, people.
Yeah, it's amazing that people still take Albright seriously when his whole case before was, you know, hey, look, a pink tarp.
Well, you know, there's a blog over at Arms Control Law that I just reviewed everything for Parchin on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go in, more and more technical people, and even Mark Gibbs and James Acton at the Carnegie Institution are casting doubt on ISIS properly, finally.
Right. In fact, yeah, I saw the guy from Carnegie fighting with him on Twitter.
Right.
Yeah, the parking lot of death. Everybody be afraid because there's a couple of sedans parked at the west end of this parking lot here.
Yeah, I mean, their basis just seems to be just to keep the word parching in the news. And
right.
they actually managed to do that by mm-hmm. putting out stupid press releases.
Right. All right, now, I accidentally took you into this break here. Hold on just a sec. I don't want the live audience to miss too much of this, Yosef, but we'll be right back in just a sec, okay?
Okay.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, talking with Yosef Butt. He's a nuclear physicist, and we're debunking some of the anti-Iran nuclear deal propaganda that's been floating around here. And, of course, David Albright from not that ISIS, the other ISIS, constantly putting out leaks and being the basis for pretended news stories by the likes of George John and David Sanger, you know, claiming alarmist things about the nature of Iran's nuclear program and what's going on there. And we were joking about, you know, oh, look, a garden hose and a pink tarp. You know, that's Corning insulation, dude. That's not a tarp. And even if it was a tarp, what the hell does that mean? You think they're washing away uranium with a hose? What is this? But it doesn't matter. As Yosef was saying, I'm sorry we went into the break there where you couldn't hear it, but he was saying, you know, it's just about keeping the name parching in the news. You know, just, oh, look, they're lying. Oh, look, they're cheating. Oh, here we are in the middle of trying to get this deal done, and here they are according to the satellites, meaning according to what David Albright claims the satellites show, something to be worried about. And you know what? You got to hand it to him, Yosef. It worked, right? A week ago, the headlines were dominated by this story that here the Iranians are sticking their middle finger at us right when Congress is debating whether to allow this thing to go through or not.
Yeah, it'd be a shame to hang this up because, you know, some NGO doesn't have the scientific skills to analyze imagery. I mean, this guy gets in front of Congress and talks about all kinds of imagery. Somebody in Congress should ask if there's any scientist at the Institute of Science and International Security or what imagery experts they have and what their training is, because I don't see it from their public side. I don't see any scientists at that institute.
Yeah, I mean, the Robert Kelly piece that, let's see, I have here somewhere. I did have it.
The bottom line on parchin is if anybody's telling you about things outside that are happening, it's not that interesting. Because what the IAEA should be interested in doing is going inside the building, and if there's a chamber, going inside the chamber and taking samples there. And that's very simple. That's what needs to be done. That's the most important thing. So it doesn't matter if there's bulldozers at the site, if there's you know, asphalting, whatever, that you don't need to pay attention to that right now.
Well, I mean, and maybe they would if there was a previous accusation that right there where they're pouring new asphalt is where we think they were doing outside tests because, again, at least as Gordon Prather puts it, the accusations of what supposedly was going on at Marivan made more sense because that's how you have to do these tests for the implosion systems is outside. But no one ever said they were doing tests outside at Parchin. They said there was this test chamber and tests going on inside. Now they're saying, oh, God, look, a bulldozer and a parking lot and a Mercedes-Benz sitting there. So what else does that mean other than, you know, pink tarp, garden hose, and again, just keep the name Parchin out there, but no specific accusation. But meanwhile, the Iranians invited the IAEA to come out to Maravan to check out what was going on out there, and the IAEA refused to come out and look, apparently because they already figured they weren't going to find anything.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when El-Baradei was the head of the IAEA, possible military dimensions PMD file, which includes Parchin and a bunch of other stuff, including Maravan, you know, it was called the alleged studies because they were only allegations. And he said there was major questions about the authenticity of it, so he didn't take it very seriously. And if you look at what happened in 2005 with Parchin, where, you know, they had open access. Iran divided it up into four bits and said, you know, pick anyone you want, go in, inspect away. And they went in once, they didn't find anything. They went another time, they didn't find anything. And then, you know, the relationship between the IAEA and Iran got sour and sour, and then they haven't allowed the IAEA back in. And I think it's because there's no flowchart of how this is going to get resolved. So hopefully that's been worked out in these agreements between the IAEA at the this large deal that's been negotiated, you know, between the IAEA and Iran. And hopefully they can work it out, and people should just wait and let them get on with their, you know, scientific work instead of trying to talk about bulldozers and and parking lots.
Well, now, so my understanding was that the IAEA had never really confronted the Iranians with the actual documents to say, how do you explain these? But now this Reuters story from Saturday says that the Iranians have just given them a whole new stack of documents, I guess, regarding past research. But I guess they're not necessarily, you know, real refutations of the PMD because they still haven't been shown the documents to refute, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding. I don't know what's been.
They're basically doing like Saddam in '95 and just saying, "Here's everything," and we don't know what else to
tell
you.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think all of it is the IAEA's problem, because I think some of the countries, you know, haven't shared it with the IAEA even. So, you know, I just don't know where the ball's been dropped on that, but you know. And some of the PMD things may actually have happened but are not necessarily nefarious. For instance, some of these floating bridge wire detonators, you know, those can be used in nuclear weapons, but they can be used in, you know, oil exploration and explosive use right. for normal oil wells. So maybe Iran, maybe that's part of the information that Iran gave over, you know, that, you know, whatever actually did happen, whatever part of the PMD file is true, you know, certainly they can respond to that. And the IAEA may have shared more information for them to respond to. I don't know.
Well, and they've had a track record for years now of successfully explaining away any number of accusations about what they're doing from, and many of which, again, can be traced back to ISIS and David Albright. Look, everybody, at these magnets. Oh, my God, the magnets. But then, yeah, there they are at this, you know, centrifuge machine at this university that has nothing to do with nuclear or anything. I mean, there it is in use. And there's all kinds of things like that where the IAEA has eventually said that we're satisfied.
That seemed to be false. For instance, those graphs that the AP Associated Press leaked a couple of years ago saying, oh, this is, you know, this is the curve for the explosion energy of a nuclear device. And if you look at it from a technical viewpoint, all the time scale doesn't make sense. It's like mathematical errors in it. Somebody's just done a botched job of you know, what it looks. Certainly, like somebody's tried to plant a fake thing because it just doesn't make sense. And, you know, that's not something that research scientists working at a national level, the kind of mistakes that they would make. So, certainly, I can see where Al-Baradei was coming from when he said that there's major questions of the authenticity of some of the documents.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, anybody who's really trying to look honestly at all this information, I think, would agree that they never really did have a nuclear weapons program. They always wanted to settle for just a capability as a half a nuclear deterrent as good enough, whether for religious reasons, really, or just strategic reasons, like they know they could never build a nuclear arsenal in time to head off the U.S. and Israel and, you know, that kind of thing. And so they just decided a decade ago, more than a decade ago, that they would just stick their hands up and open their books up and say, see, we're not making nukes. Don't shoot. And they would just try to do a better job of pleading not guilty than Saddam ever did, you know, and in order to avoid regime change. And that's been their policy this whole time.
Yeah, I mean, basically the bottom line, like, it'd be a shame because the deal that's been negotiated is very tough on Iran. There's very intrusive inspections. You know, it's a good deal. It makes sense for everybody. Everyone's agreed to it. And then if these people, you know, shouting from the sidelines, these non-scientists at ISIS, managed to sabotage it because of their propaganda, that'd be a real shame.
Absolutely. All right, well, listen, thanks for doing your part to help push back against it with real scientific credentials here at Reuters. Iran gives UN watchdog information. Oh, nope, that's the wrong article I'm looking at here. Well, I was on the right website, Yosef. It's why it's impossible to hide nuclear work in 24 days or 24 years by Yosef Butt at Reuters.com. Thanks very much for coming back on the show. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And again, Yosef is senior scientific advisor to the British American Security Information Council in London. And we'll be right back with Charles Goyette in just a sec.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Next up is Charles Goyette, good friend and legendary radio host out of Phoenix, Arizona, author of The Dollar Meltdown and Red, Blue, and Broke All Over, which is about the United States. Hey, welcome back, Charles. How are you?
Scott, great to speak to you, bud.
Hey, man, are you still doing the thing with Ron on the radio all the time?
No, we wrap that up at the end of the year. It kind of led its natural life, and I'm glad that Daniel McAdams moved down to his neck of the woods so that they could be together in studio and on camera, and they do a great great daily commentary. So it kind of what we were doing is really needed, you know, to do one commentary a week on a podcast when they're doing it daily. So we wrapped it up at the end of the year, and I'm very pleased with what they're doing now.
I guess I was most excited about y'all being syndicated out there on AM radio and coming on during, you know, commercials during Rush Limbaugh and then the After Rush clone on every town's major AM and then have Ron Paul and Charles Goyette interjecting with a little bit of common sense and sort of you understand what I mean, from the right too.
That was a great run. We did that for, I guess, about 2 years, and we were on, I've forgotten now, but it was certainly a couple hundred radio stations. And so we had great reach. And you're right, you know, one of the local stations here in Phoenix where I live ran the commentary in the middle of some neocon talk show. And it was always, you know, sort of a breath of fresh air and a point counterpoint, you know, to hear Ron put the exact opposite of what these people have been listening to for 3 hours, hear him put succinctly in a 2-minute radio spot, you know, what the real situation was. I just loved it.
Yeah, man, that's always fun. You know, and especially coming from Ron, because he's just so obviously right. I mean, he just completely dismantles the war party's arguments and with such ease. And with you as Ed McMahon, you know, setting him up it's just, you know, it's ridiculously good. So anyway, well, I'm glad that y'all got away with it for as long as you did anyway. Anyway, so hey, welcome to the show. I want to talk to you about the economy. TV says it ain't so bad. Except, you know, the people seem to think that it is, and I think that, hey, Bill Clinton was right about one thing, maybe only in life, and that's, it's the economy, stupid. And it seems pretty obvious that the reason that people are flocking to Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump is because they're not politicians. They seem like outsiders. They seem like populists who actually care about the people instead of just power in Washington, D.C. And they're hurting. They want somebody to fix it. And so Donald Trump says, well, look, it's the poor people's fault and it's lousy trade agreement's fault. He's going to shut down the trade and he's going to, you know, kick out all the lousy immigrants who are taking our jobs and that kind of thing. And then, of course, Bernie Sanders says, well, it's obviously all the billionaires' fault. They're the ones with the power. They're the ones with the bailouts, and they're the ones who've done this to us. And so we need to get rid of these trade agreements and tax the hell out of Donald Trump and the rest of his guys. And the American people seem divided between pretty much those two positions, at least so far in this race, and don't have a minute for Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, which let me take a minute to praise their disdain for the establishment. But, you know, populism is not necessarily always libertarian, as we can see in the case of these two candidates. And I just wonder about, you know, what's your read on the true state of the economy and these populist candidates and what you think of their economic programs and all these kinds of cool things.
Well, you put your finger on it. There's nothing so great as the sore thumb. There's nothing so visibly wrong. There's nothing so egregious in America's economic life as the distortions of crony capitalism and the windfall for the banksters and the war profiteers and others. And it has reached the point of being disgusting. So Americans left and right and in between all see that. I mean, that is the single signpost that they are following in this election. And you're right, whether it's Trump on one side or Bernie Sanders on the other side, they are all responding to this egregious crony capitalism. I saw, Scott, back, I will guess it was probably in May, I saw Mort Zuckerman on the John McLaughlin show.
This is the editor of U.S. News World Report.
Yes, and a New York real estate billionaire. And the question to close out the show went around the round table and Pat Buchanan and Eleanor Clift and yada, yada, yada. And the question was, what will you do if you wake up in the morning and on election day in November and it's Jeb or it's Hillary? And everybody went around with their partisan thing, you know, the left guy about, well, you know, if Jeb would be bad, Hillary would be great, and so on. This went around and finally ended up on Mort Zuckerman's desk, and he said, if the nominees are Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, I will go to sleep early that night without even bothering to watch the returns, and I will awaken with a smile on my face in the morning because I know that either way the Republic is in good hands.
Oh,
and of course, he would. I mean, here is, here is the certainty that the Fed will keep stovepiping, newly created money to Wall Street in the administration of either one of them. So that, New York real estate billionaires would be very, very happy indeed, as they have been over the last 10 years or so. So, I mean, we're really in a fix, and it pains me deeply to see people flocking to Bernie Sanders and to Donald Trump under the circumstances, because it simply means they're not discerning. They see the problem. They see the malady of crony capitalism and the distortions in the economy as a result of it, and they think something must be done, and they're right, and so they're willing to take any kind of a medicine, any prescription at all will do, whether it's Dr. Trump's or Dr. Sanders, and of course both of them are the sorts of things that will make the patient sick. I mean, it's like the cure that's worse than the disease. It's like there's nothing holistic about the medical treatment. It's let's find a chemotherapy that may kill the problem everybody's concerned about, but it will kill the patient at the same time, which they will do, drive a nail into the hands and feet of the economy and bury it with a stake in its heart. So this pains me deeply, and you probably saw this. Bob Wenzel at Economic Policy Journal and Target Liberty did a good job looking at Ron Paul's Facebook page. Ron posted just a short comment or two about Bernie Sanders' economic confusion and economic statism. And here were all of the Ron Paul fans. People obviously have to be fans of Ron. They're going to his Facebook page, right? All of these Ron Paul fans start posting on there why, well, Ron, you don't understand, you know, why Bernie's the man. Bernie has to be the man because he's willing to take on the crony capitalists and so on. And if the Ron Paul people, if the people who have been educated by Ron Paul since 2007, you know, don't really understand the destruction of Bernie Sanders' state socialism or Marxist economics, then who stands as a bulwark against this kind of economic cataclysm? Nobody. If Ron Paul's people don't get it, nobody does.
Well, Ron does. I went to his birthday party the other day, and I actually got there late, and I only caught half his speech. But what he was saying was, so that's why all we need is liberty. And that's why, no matter what happens, if we have economic calamity, there'd be an adjustment period. But assuming that we could just get some sound money and some, you know, I don't know how else to paraphrase them, basically, let prices float on the market, let the bankrupt go bankrupt, and move on, then we'd be all right. And now that goddamn music's playing, Charles, but when we get back, I'm going to ask you about that because, you know, if I was a right-winger or a left-winger, I would say, yeah, that's all utopian and I don't believe you. And so I'm going to challenge you because I already know that you agree with Ron. So hang on, everybody. It's the great Charles Goyette, author of Red, Blue, and Broke All Over. He's talking about you.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. So I'm talking with Charles Goyette about the economy and the government. One of the big tragedies of the campaign of 07-08 is that the economy crashed, the stock market and the rest of the economy with it, all the housing market and everything, in September 08 instead of September 07. Ron had been running for a good, 8 months saying, yeah, the economy, man, it's in real bad shape. And everyone's saying, you don't know what you're talking about. And he would say, you don't know what you're talking about. There's a real problem. There's severe bubbles and there's a correction coming due. And man, if it had hit 1 year earlier and then he'd been able to run all through 08 as the Austrian who told you so that whole time, man, that would have been something else instead of what it was instead. But anyway, so here we are without a Ron. But like I was saying on the other side of the break, that I heard Ron at his FFF speech here at UT a few months back and then again at his birthday party. What he has to say all the time is there's a natural order. You know, liberty works. Believe in liberty. Trust in liberty. Don't resort to knee-jerk solutions. Trust in freedom and things will be okay. So right-wingers, you don't need to clamp down on free trade and latch on to other kind of protectionist and anti-economic things. And the liberals, you don't need to resort to the 10 million different kinds of interventions that you can think of that you'd like to try out on us all. Just let everybody be. But then, let me pretend I'm a Democrat for a minute. That's crazy. What he's really saying is, let the billionaires do whatever they want, Charles, and screw everybody else or something like that.
Yeah, doesn't rise to the level of adolescent analysis. It's infantile analysis. Look,
that's consensus, pal.
I'm telling you, you had investment banks that had been around since the Civil War, like Bear Stearns, that they had survived World War I, World War II, the Great Depression, on and on and on and on. And all of a sudden, these banks that have been around forever, they all started failing and falling apart at the same time. There is a term for that in economics. It's called a cluster of errors. And when you see, look, there's always going to be a rogue bank or a dumb banker or a, you know, a speculator or some strung out crackhead banker that goes out and does highly speculative stuff and loses everybody's money at the bank, including the shareholders of the bank, who are the first line of defense against that kind of madness, including the board of directors. Everybody, you know, everybody is shamed and hurt by the rogue behavior of the rogue banks. You're always going to have one of those here and there over the course of time. But what we had is everybody operating off the same playbook. And when you have everybody sailing the same way, I likened it in one of my books to when the pirates of old used to create these false, these fake lighthouses, and they sent bad signals to the sailing ships, the commerce ships. And so being misled by these false lighthouses, the ships would crack up on the reefs, and the pirates would go in and plunder all the goods that were cracked up on the smashed up ship. Well, this is what you have with the Fed, you know, centralizing the function of interest rates, which, after all, what are interest rates? They are a price. They're supposed to communicate information about the supply and demand of credit, about willing borrowers and willing lenders. They're supposed to convey information. When that information is false, just like a fake lighthouse, then you have all sorts of people acting at once on that false information. It's not just one rogue banker at Bear Stearns. It's a whole industry responding to signals that are being sent to it by artificially contrived interest rates instead of normal, organic interest rates that are left free to reflect real conditions of supply and demand. And so all of the problems of the Fed's bubbles, you know, the dot-com bubble and the housing bubble and the current bubble that they've created, all of these problems get replicated over and over again, and they compound problems in ways that are not even that are unintended. You have elderly people that should be seeking safety and safe investment vehicles that can't get an interest rate return, so they're taking higher levels of risk to get, you know, on their life savings to keep the bills paid in their golden years, higher levels of risk than they should, and they will probably universally suffer as a result of that. Is that because elderly people in this day and age suddenly got stupid? No, it's because of the centralized economic signals, the misleading economic signals about credit conditions that have been engineered by the world's central banks. So they're creating another one for us as we speak now, and it is a calamity. Actually, Scott, it's a calamity. I wouldn't say that it's waiting to happen, because it's kind of begun to happen right now. You know, the growth disappoints, business inventories are starting to grow. You know, most recessions throughout time are inventory recessions. You know, businesses build up a lot of inventory, they have unsold inventory, and so all of a sudden they stop buying from producers because they've got to work down this inventory. Well, you got inventories rising now, so you have an inventory recession that could clearly kick off what would be something much, much larger than a garden variety simple inventory recession.
All right, now a couple of other things here. I read a Stockman piece about China and their insane monetary policy and crony system. I mean, their system of, mercantilism plus totalitarianism. Sure. Is just fascism, right? Or what else do you call it? Boy, do they have distortions in their market, and yet these things that Stockman calls iron laws of economics are coming due over there. And there's another piece in the American Conservative today by a guy named Charles Hugh Smith saying, forget the Chinese stock market. Look at their housing market. When that thing goes, and I'm sure Stockman would pile on with this, when that thing goes, it's going to drag the whole world down with it. Now, is that really possible? Is everybody that cross-invested in everybody else's bogus housing bonds, or what the hell? Really?
Basically, I would say, yeah, it's, you know the old story, butterfly flaps its wings in China. Well, this is much bigger. This is the dragon flapping its wings. Listen, China, you know, I think I'm the only person I know that would actually read this, but I read a prolonged interview with one of the senior central bankers, their equivalent of the Federal Reserve central bankers of China's central bank, about a year or so ago, and it was a long piece. And I thought, well, this will really reveal some stuff. This could have been written by Paul Krugman. It could have been an interview with Ben Bernanke.
It could
have been done by the Princeton Economics Department. It's the same economic thinking. It's the same Keynesian madness that brought us the calamity of 2008 and that is bringing the same sort of thing on. It's the same economic policies. You know, these Keynesians and funny money central bankers prevail all over the world. Mm-hmm. So, of course, what we went through in 2008 will be replicated there because they've replicated the monetary policies that brought it on. Mm-hmm. And are we all interconnected? Oh, yeah, I would say we're all interconnected. I mean, China's devaluation means that the Keynesians and the mad people around the world follows only on the heels of Japan's devaluation. Everybody scrambling to make their currency cheaper in hopes to get a bigger share of the global market, when the global market, by the way, is a non-growth market to begin with. So everybody's, you know, willing to trash their own currency in hopes to get a little bigger share of an economy, a global economy that's not growing. Well, all the currencies of the world can't be the cheapest. And so, but they will continue destroying their currencies, as will the United States, you know, in an effort to gain a competitive advantage on a currency basis. So they have created, we are on the edge of a precipice now.
Man, well, you know, it's interesting because you don't have to be an Austrian really, right? Because I don't think anybody would say that Paul Volcker was a Austrian school guy. He was a Chase Manhattan banker. And yet he came in and said, listen, inflation forever isn't working. We need a recession and I'm going to make one. Watch me. And then he made one and then everybody agreed that it worked. So never mind, you know, anything coming out of, you know, Auburn, Alabama or anything like that. But just what about experience of the Reagan years? Doesn't that lesson, don't the Japanese, of course, have the same problem when they're living through a perpetual 1970s over there for the same, you know, Keynesian reasons, basically. It seems like, you know, wouldn't they ever question, hey, maybe we could, especially in China where they're communists and nobody's overthrowing them. They got the PLA. They could force a recession for a couple of years, get a good reset and start again or something like that. Let prices fall to normal. Let people move into those mega cities that they've built for no one at actual market prices instead of the ridiculously propped up ones. But no one seems to ever take that lesson. They just keep printing and printing and printing. How come?
Well, it's not just the economic lesson, though. It's because it kind of takes us full circle because it's you know, it's all cronyism in China as well. So, you know, the people that built the mega cities, the people that own the giant apartments, that they are government functionaries or brother-in-laws or tied in. They are cronies in one respect or another. So they use their not economic influence, but their crony connections to try to prevent the reckoning or the adjustment of the prices that represents their personal wealth. So they use political means to prevent or to forestall the economic correction or the clearing of the malinvestment that has been, you know, has been their livelihood.
Just like in the USA.
Of course, it is exactly the same thing.
Mm. Now, you know, America, we have some in California and in Florida. Maybe you could find neighborhoods where nobody lived and nobody was buying at these prices. Maybe a whole valley here or there in California. But in China, they built these mega cities. So these are distortions that I don't think the world has ever seen before, economically speaking, where for political reasons, money is shoveled into projects in the tens and I mean, I guess Lockheed is a good comparison, but we get nothing for that. In this case, they build these giant cities for, you know, tens of billions of dollars, I guess, to build them. And it just seems like, well, maybe like we're talking about, if they really have a severe crash that printing money can't halt, and that could bring down America. But on the other hand, could that prop up the dollar? Everybody's been talking about the BRICS. Oh, it's the rise of the BRICS. They're going to make the dollar obsolete, and then it'll be the end of dollar hegemony. But if, you know, China is the powerhouse of the BRICS, and their economy is so distorted, then what real threat does that pose to the empire?
Oh, this is a huge threat to the empire, since they're our chief creditor. I mean, you know, who buys American debt? Who wants to buy American debt that pays you basically nothing Who wants U.S. Treasury bonds, a 30-year U.S. Treasury instrument, a 10-year Treasury instrument that pays you, you know, 1 or 2% in the face of quantitative easing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and ad infinitum? So we are utterly dependent on the kindness of foreign strangers to keep our debt funded. And all politics is local. You don't need Tip O'Neill to tell you that. When China needs their reserves to buy off the populace to keep social upheaval minimized in the streets there because of the economic calamity that they've created, what do? Do they buy more U.S. bonds? Do they buy more bonds, or do they liquidate what they possibly can in the market in an orderly or disorderly manner to spend the money locally to appease the peasants with the pitchforks?
So it's not just a matter of the boom and bust that we have to suffer through, but there's a real limit, you say, to just how long they can keep printing money and keep going into debt here. Because it seems like, you know, I don't know, I think a lot of Austrians thought that we wouldn't have just another big set of bubbles this time around, that this time we would have widespread price inflation across the board because of all the QE. And that really hasn't happened. So maybe they can. Maybe we'll have to suffer the boom bust, but maybe they'll still be able to just keep printing dollars forever. Why not? Keep buying up bad debt.
They can certainly keep things going longer. It's just like any market, you know, a bull market seems to always go higher than you could reasonably anticipate, and a bear market goes lower than intellectually seems sound. So they can keep these games going sometimes longer than one would imagine. But, for example, in the case of the United States, Scott, nobody could possibly have anticipated, or those that did anticipate should get a gold star for doing so, that the Fed would actually pay American banks not to loan money, because it is in the loaning of money that jobs are created. So if you have, you know, substandard employment, if you have unemployment and that is substandard and underemployment that is substandard, you would think that the cure for that would be for people to save money, for banks to loan money, to create jobs, you know, new capital equipment, so on and so forth. But instead, the Fed has pursued a policy for, let's say, 7 years now of encouraging the banks not to loan money. And all of the Austrians I know, and myself included, have said, you know, the process of massive monetary explosion, of this compounding of the monetary base, all of this is dependent on businesses borrowing in the fractional reserve banking system. So for the intervening few years, the Fed has been in the business of paying the banks to leave their money in neutral, in shrink wrap, basically in the basement of the Mariner Eccles building, and not loan it into the economy.
Yeah. So, well, I think, you know, Higgs was on the show last week, Robert Higgs, and he was saying, you know, the Fed is actually paying them 0.25% or some tiny amount to keep the money there, really. And there are a lot of other reasons why they're not loaning it out, such as just the economy's different, you know, numbers are soft in so many ways. It's still not economical to loan it out, even though they're really barely bribing them not to.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, why take a risk when you can have a risk-free return in a in an era of uncertainty and pending regime change, to use a Higgs term? When things are uncertain in the economy, why take a risk, especially with what everybody went through in 2007, 8, 9, 10, and so on, when you can get a risk-free return? And that's basically what they're doing. So the Fed has distorted the economy again. They've created another huge bubble. Look, this to me is basic Austrian economics. You got, you know, you've got the government, the state central bank, always seeking to inflate the supply of money and credit. And the market is always seeking to correct the excesses. So you have this constant battle been going on back and forth in this country. The Fed's constantly trying to reinflate the last bubble, the housing bubble, the automobile bubble, whatever it may be, student loan bubble, constantly trying to force more money into the system to inflate the bubble again. And yet the economy is constantly trying to get its feet back on the earth and correct the excesses. So nobody wants to loan money in an economy that is rife with malinvestment. So they could take a risk-free return from the Fed in the meantime, you know, keep their powder dry, keep their capital intact, I mean, it makes pretty good sense. So the Fed is the enemy of the growth of the American economy. The Fed is creating yet another massive distortion that is hurting. It is hurting savers. It hurts investors. It increases the amount of risk that people take to their ultimate peril. You know, the Fed is all doing all of this to serve the interests of the power group, the banking community that created it in the first place. Is that such a surprise that they would do that?
Nope. Sounds like that's the story of the entire Constitution. It's all regulatory capture from the convention of 1787 onwards, I think.
Isn't it, though? Yep.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for coming back on the show. I've kept you way over time here, but it's great to talk to you again, my friend.
Scott, you do such great work. It's great to talk to you. Thank you, sir.
All right, y'all. That's Charles Goyette. Red and Blue and Broke All Over is his book. And if you donate $100 to the show, you get one in your mail. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate. And also check out Charles's great website, charlesgoyette.com. Thanks, y'all. See ya.